Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners. So we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Mario Ritter Jr., Armin Kasabian, and Jill Robbins. Later, we will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Mario Ritter Jr.
Experts from the World Health Organization are expected to start their search for the beginnings of the new coronavirus when they arrive in China this week. China's National Health Commission made the announcement in a one-sentence statement Monday. The experts will arrive on Thursday and meet with Chinese officials. No additional details were made available. It remains unclear whether the experts will travel to the central Chinese city of Wuhan, where the coronavirus was first found in late 2019. Negotiations for the visit have taken a long time. WHO Director General Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus expressed concern last week over delays. He said members of the international scientific team had already left their home countries. The trip was part of an agreement between the WHO and the Chinese government. Earlier, a United Nations spokesperson told reporters at UN headquarters in New York that Secretary General Antonio Guterres is fully supportive of Dr. Tedros and WHO's efforts to get a team in there. Foreign Ministry spokesperson Zhao Lijian said China had approved the visit after talks between the two sides. He called it a chance to exchange opinions, with Chinese scientists and medical experts, on scientific cooperation on the tracing of the origin of the new coronavirus. Zhao suggested that the origin would likely involve multiple countries and localities. China's government has controlled all research into the origins of the virus in the country, an Associated Press investigation found. State-operated media have spread theories that suggest the virus could have started outside of China. An AP investigation found that China's government is handing out hundreds of thousands of dollars in aid to scientists researching the virus's origins in southern China. But it is watching their findings, and it ordered that the publication of any information or research be approved by a new committee supervised by China's cabinet. The AP found through internal documents that the research is under direct orders from President Xi Jinping. The culture of secrecy is believed to have delayed warnings about the pandemic. It blocked the sharing of information with the WHO and slowed early efforts at testing. Reports say WHO officials felt frustration over not getting the information they needed to fight the spread of the deadly virus. Australia and other countries have called for an investigation into the origins of the virus. That call has been met with anger from China. The virus's origins have caused much speculation. Much of it centered on the likelihood that it was carried by bats and passed to humans through an intermediary animal. It is thought the animal was sold as food or medicine in traditional Chinese markets. China has largely limited new cases, but said Monday that tests show 103 people have been infected with the coronavirus in Hebei province, bordering Beijing. That outbreak comes as officials are trying to limit the spread of the virus during next month's Lunar New Year holiday. Officials have called on citizens not to travel, ordered schools to close 1 week early, and carried out many tests. China has recorded more than 87,536 total cases of the virus. Hospitals are currently treating hundreds of people for COVID-19, while about 506 other people have been separated from others. Those 506 are under observation after tests showed them to have the virus with no signs of sickness, officials said. The Hebei outbreak has raised concern because the province surrounds Beijing. People in parts of the province are having their movements restricted and travel has been largely cut off. Those entering Beijing have to show proof of employment as well as proof that they do not have the virus. I'm Mario Ritter Jr.
Malaysian researchers have found a new use for waste from processing pineapples, making parts for small, pilotless aircraft drones. Researchers developed a method to use pineapple leaves to make airframes for the drones. Pineapples are harvested once a year in Malaysia. The leaves are thrown away because there is little use for them. Until now. Professor Muhammad Tariq Hamid Sultan is the director of the project. He teaches at Malaysia's Putra University. He has been trying to find uses for pineapple waste created by farmers in an area around 65 kilometers from the capital, Kuala Lumpur. We are transforming the leaf of the pineapple into a fiber that can be used for a drone, he told Reuters. Muhammad Tariq explained that natural materials can be better than man-made ones. They are less costly, lighter, and stronger when compared by weight. Experimental drones made of the new material have been able to fly up to about 1,000 meters and stay in the air for about 20 minutes, he added. If the drone is damaged, the frame can be buried in the ground and will fully break down within 2 weeks, he said. The research team hopes to create a larger drone that is more profitable to sell. It would include sensors for agricultural purposes and to take pictures. The Malaysian Unmanned Drones Activist Society is a non-governmental group helping to design the drone and advising on the project. William Robert Alviz is a member of the group. He said, "Our role here is to help the industry, the farmers, to increase their yield and make their jobs much easier. Farmers hope that the new use for pineapple leaves will lead to higher incomes for themselves and their families." Erwin Ismail is a pineapple farmer. Ismail said Malaysia is suffering from economic and health problems from the spread of the coronavirus. Society is desperate, and there is no alternative to increase income, he said. I'm Armin Kasabian.
Social studies teachers across the United States are changing their plans for lessons this week. They want to help young people make sense of the news about the violence in Washington. Carly Reising is a social studies teacher at Robert E. Fitch High School in Groton, Connecticut. In almost every single one of my classes, the students brought it up before I even could, she said. And she added, my seniors were really struggling with what this meant about the future of our country in a way that was pretty heartbreaking. Reising and others said they talked about the importance of being involved with the process of government. They wanted to lead students away from the idea that there must be violence to end a political fight. Michael Neagle teaches at Lowell High School in Massachusetts. After finishing his class on Thursday, January 7th, he said it was one of the most important days he had as a teacher. He wants his students to be active in civic life. We don't want kids to tune out and just say, well, this is how it is. Nobody gets along. Politics. That voter apathy is so dangerous, he said. South St. Paul, Minnesota teacher Mark Westfall showed the morning newspapers to his sixth grade students learning online. His school is near the place where George Floyd died. His students asked questions about the police response that will carry into later lessons. He planned to talk in future classes about how the two events can be compared to each other. What was the response like? What was the media presence like? He said. As Westfall taught his 10 and 11-year-old students on a video conference, three or four parents appeared without speaking. He wondered about their thoughts. Many teachers working online record their lessons so parents can study them with their students at home. One Washington, D.C. area teacher heard that some of her students had parents in the National Guard group working at the Capitol on Wednesday. This made her think carefully about the feelings of her students and their parents. In Alabama, 10th grade teacher Blake Busman said he too thought about how students and the community would respond to his actions and words. He said he chooses his words very carefully. Busman is a teacher at Auburn High School. He made a point to let students watch the unrest on TV. He was a high school senior on September 11, 2001, when terrorists attacked the United States with hijacked passenger jets. At that time, the school chief did not permit television in school. Busman felt he lost an opportunity to watch history in the making. The day after the attack on the U.S. Capitol, he woke early and gathered 25 photographs. He showed each one for 10 to 15 seconds without saying anything, then asked students to write poems. He wanted students to first think quietly about what happened. The students did not write their names on the poems, and they did not read them in class. Busman said they helped him understand students' thoughts and guide his future teaching. The poems, he said, show a desire for a more harmonious government, a more cooperative approach, and a belief that things can get better. In David McMullen's classroom at Great Path Academy in Manchester, Connecticut, students argued about the identity of the attackers. He asked his students to write their thoughts about the event for future historians. "I tell my students, they are the future's primary sources," he said. "Teachers usually stay away from voicing their opinions, or if they do talk about them, identify them as their own opinions." Rising said the conversation among her students was difficult because many have never met face to face. She tried, however, to end the discussion on a hopeful note. As young adults, she sees her students as citizens who can be active in government without using violence. Connor Murphy teaches at West Genesee High School in Camillus, New York. He remembered the 9/11 attacks when he was in an American history class and watched the second plane hit the World Trade Center in New York. He said it was important to help students understand the historical importance of such an event. A year ago, he had a similar job teaching participation in government during President Donald Trump's impeachment trial in Congress. But, he said, "I've never really had to teach anything quite so, in my opinion, profound." I'm Jill Robbins.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. In 1914, Europe exploded into the First World War. It was a war no nation really wanted, but no nation seemed able to stop it. The assassination of Austria's Archduke Franz Ferdinand in the city of Sarajevo was the spark that set off the explosion. Harry Monroe and Kay Gallant tell about the war and how it affected the United States under President Woodrow Wilson.
The Austrian Archduke was murdered by Serbian nationalists. They opposed Austrian control of their homeland. After the assassination, Austria declared war on Serbia. One of Serbia's allies was Russia. Russia agreed to help Serbia in any war against Austria. Austria had allies, too. The most important was Germany. Germany wanted Russia to stay out of the war. When Russia refused, Germany declared war on Russia. Then Germany declared war on Russia's close ally, France. Britain entered the war a few days later, when Germany violated the neutrality of Belgium.
One nation after another entered the conflict to protect its friends or to honor its treaties. Within a week, most of Europe was at war. On one side were the Central Powers, Germany and Austria-Hungary. On the other side were the Triple Entente allies, France, Britain, and Russia. Many other nations took sides. Bulgaria and Turkey joined the Central Powers. Italy, Romania, Portugal, and Greece joined the Allies.
The United States hoped to stay out of the war. President Wilson immediately declared American neutrality. He said, "It is a war with which we have nothing to do, whose causes cannot touch us." Most Americans agreed with President Wilson. They did not want to get involved in the fighting. However, many found it difficult to remain neutral in their hearts. Some Americans had family roots in Germany. They supported the Central Powers. A greater number of Americans had family roots in Britain or France. They supported the Allies. Yet the official American policy was neutrality. The United States planned to continue to trade with both sides.
Germany and Austria expected a quick victory in the war. They were caught between two powerful enemies, Russia and France. But German military leaders were not worried. They had a battle plan they were sure would succeed. The German generals planned to strike quickly at France with most of the German army. They expected to defeat France in a short time and then turn to fight Russia. In this way, the German army would not have to fight both enemies at the same time.
At first, the plan worked. 2 million German soldiers swept across Belgium and into France. They rushed forward toward Paris, hoping for a fast victory. But the German commanders made a mistake. They pushed their men too fast. When British and French forces struck back outside Paris, the tired and worn German soldiers could not hold their positions. The battle was fierce and unbelievably bloody. In the end, the Germans were forced to withdraw. The German withdrawal gave the Allies time to prepare strong defenses. There was no chance now for a quick German victory. Instead, it would be a long war, with Germany and Austria facing enemies on two sides. Britain and France were on the west, Russia was on the east.
The Allies took immediate steps to reduce Germany's trade with the rest of the world. The British Navy began seizing war supplies found on neutral ships sailing toward German ports. It then expanded its efforts to block food exports to Germany. The blockade by Britain and the other Allies was very successful. Germany faced possible starvation. Its navy was not strong enough to break the blockade with surface ships. Its only hope was to break the blockade with another naval weapon, submarines. Germany announced that it would use its submarines to sink any ship that came near the coast of Britain. The threat included ships from neutral nations that tried to continue trading with the Allies.
The United States and other neutral nations immediately protested the German announcement. They said it was a clear violation of international law. When a German submarine sank a British ship in the Irish Sea, one of the victims was an American citizen. A few weeks later, an American oil ship was damaged during a sea battle between British Navy ships and a German submarine. Then came the most serious incident of all. It involved a British passenger ship called the Lusitania. The Lusitania was sailing from New York City to Britain when it was attacked by a German submarine. The Lusitania sank in 18 minutes. 1,200 persons were killed. 129 were Americans.
The sinking of the Lusitania shocked and horrified the American people. They called it mass murder. They turned against Germany. President Wilson warned that he might declare war on Germany if Germany continued to sink civilian ships. Germany did not want war with the United States. It already faced a strong fight against the European allies. It promised not to sink any more civilian ships without warning, and it offered regrets for the Lusitania incident.
President Wilson accepted Germany's apology. Like most Americans, he hoped to stay out of the bloody European struggle. And he also knew that the record of the Allies was not completely clean. For example, he was troubled by reports of mass hunger in Germany. He and other Americans felt the British food blockade was cruel. They also were shocked by the way British forces brutally crushed a rebellion in Ireland at the time. Most of all, the American people were sickened by reports of what was happening on the battlefields of Europe. The armies were using poison gas and other terrible weapons. Soldiers on both sides were dying by the millions. The war had become a bloodbath.
The United States had a presidential election in 1916. President Wilson won the nomination of the Democratic Party to seek re-election. Democrats around the country shouted their support with these words, "He kept us out of war." Wilson himself did not like the words. He felt it raised false hopes. But people continued to say it because they did not want war.
The Republican Party nominated Supreme Court Justice Charles Evans Hughes as its candidate for president. Hughes was a moderate Republican. He supported a number of social reforms. Like Wilson, Hughes promised to keep the United States neutral. However, one of his supporters was former President Theodore Roosevelt. And Roosevelt called for strong American policies that could lead to war. Roosevelt's words led many Americans to see Wilson as the candidate of peace, and Hughes as the candidate of war.
Voting in the presidential election was very close. At first, it seemed Hughes had won. He went to bed on election night, believing he would be America's next president. But voting results later that night confirmed Wilson as the winner. The election was so close, the Republicans did not accept defeat for 2 weeks. Woodrow Wilson had won another term. During that term, he would find it increasingly difficult to honor the words of the campaign, "He kept us out of war." Finally, he would find it impossible. The United States entered World War I while Woodrow Wilson was president.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.
This is VOA News. Reporting by remote, I'm David Byrd. The U.S. House of Representatives is holding an emotional debate as it prepares to vote to impeach President Donald Trump for inciting insurrection last week when thousands of his supporters stormed the Capitol in a riot that left five people dead. AP's Sagar Meghani reports.
Resolved that Donald John Trump, President of the United States, is impeached for high crimes and misdemeanors.
For the second time in 13 months, House Democrats are arguing for President Trump's removal, with Speaker Nancy Pelosi saying he incited an armed rebellion at the Capitol.
He is a clear and present danger to the nation.
Republicans like Jim Jordan argue this is simply Democrats continuing an obsession with canceling the president.
We should be focused on bringing the nation together. Instead, Democrats are going to impeach the president for a second time, one week before he leaves office.
It's unclear how impeachment may move in the Senate. A GOP strategist says Republican leader Mitch McConnell believes the president did commit impeachable offenses and told donors this weekend he's through with the president. Sagar Meghani, Washington.
The head of Human Rights Watch said on Wednesday that U.S. President-elect Joe Biden should bring fundamental change to American policy on human rights and allow criminal investigations of President Donald Trump to show that the president is not above the law. Kenneth Roth lamented what he called 4 years of Trump's indifference and often hostility to human rights.
His flouting of human rights at home and his embrace of friendly autocrats around the world severely eroded U.S. credibility on human rights.
Roth's comments came as Human Rights Watch issued its annual World Report 2021 that chronicles concerns about human rights in more than 100 countries around the world. This is VOA News. Prominent Kremlin critic Alexei Navalny says he will fly back to Russia from Germany, where he has been recovering after being poisoned. Reuters' Emily Wither reports.
Navalny says he's almost fully recovered.
The last thing Putin can do is to put a large placard on the Kremlin reading, "Alexei, please, under any circumstances, do not return home." But coming to Germany was not my choice. It's a cool country, but I'm here not by my own will. I am here because they tried to kill me.
His announcement came a day after court documents showed Russian authorities had asked a court to jail him. The charge? He allegedly broke the terms of a suspended sentence for what Navalny says was a politically motivated conviction. Writing on social media, he says he's not interested in what Putin's servants might do to him. Russia is his country.
That's Reuters' Emily Wither. Britain's prime minister says the coronavirus vaccine program will operate around the clock 7 days a week as soon as possible, AP's Charles de Ledesma reports.
Boris Johnson says at the moment the limit is on supply of the vaccines rather than on the ability of the country's health service to deliver jabs quickly. The push to inoculate millions comes as a more contagious variant of COVID-19 is sweeping across Britain and driving hospitals to their breaking points. The government has set a goal of delivering the first vaccine doses to everyone over 70, as well as frontline healthcare workers, nursing home residents, and anyone whose health makes them especially vulnerable to the virus by the middle of February. That's more than 15 million people. Charles de Ledesma, London.
Members of the World Health Organization's expert team have departed from their home countries ahead of their investigation of the origins of the coronavirus pandemic in Wuhan, China. The experts are due to arrive in Wuhan on Thursday, where the first human coronavirus cases were reported. China has rejected calls for an independent investigation while strictly controlling all research into the origins of the virus and promoting fringe theories that the virus might have actually been brought to China from the outside. Consumer prices have posted their biggest increase in 4 months, AP's Mike Hempen reports.
The Labor Department says consumer prices were up 0.4% in December. The increase was mainly due to a nearly 8.5% hike in gasoline prices. However, gas prices are still 15% lower than they were a year ago when people were still commuting to work. Mike Hempen, Washington.
You can find more on our website, voanews.com. Reporting by remote, I'm David Byrd, VOA News.
Ooh, yeah, my Hello again, Africa. Welcome to your super show, The African Beat on the Voice of America. From our studio here in Washington, D.C., I am David Vandy. Hot, rocking, and beautiful sounds from the great continent of Africa will be knocking on your doors again today, so I want you to relax because I'm going to take you on a trip around Africa on disc. But right now, let's start off from the Democratic Republic of Congo as I take your mind back. Way, way back to Isambe, the sound of Kanda Bongo Man. Yeah, that is going to be real groovy. And right after that, Bivote, the sound of Afro Combo 87 from Sierra Leone, and Mwaye by Oliver Ngoma of Gabon. But first, Isambe by Kanda Bongo Man from the Democratic Republic of Congo.
the show, baby.
Mwaye by Oliver Ngoma of Gabon, and before that, Bivote by Afrocombo 87 of Sierra Leone, and Isambe by Kanda Bongoman of the Democratic Republic of Congo. The African beat on The Voice of America, broadcasting Mondays through Fridays at 0905 and 2005 UTC. And I'm David Vandy. I'll be right back.
Hi, I am Devoa. I love the African beat on The Voice of America. It's hot and it's good to go.
Welcome back to the show that brings happiness into your homes and smiles on your faces. The African beat on The Voice of America. More music coming, and this time to Uganda's Josie Chameleone, Dr. Josie Chameleone in Mama Mbire. Beautiful music. Mama Mbire by Josie Chameleone of Uganda. This is your super show, the African beat on The Voice of America.
African beats.
Africa.
Africa.
Voice of America.
Bye.
We can take it on the sofa. It's 2 in the morning. We can take it to the bay. Then I will kiss your lips. The way you want it, you got me screaming. I know it's me, but maybe we can do it like Valentine. Baby, I'm feeling.